It's music from Michael Card. Older than the rain. Sin is older than the rain. 10 minutes after the hour, it's 8 o'clock here in our central time zone. And it's 10 minutes after 8 o'clock, that's it. And it's a Wednesday morning. And, of course, that means Doug Greenwald from Preserving Bible Times. Doug, the executive director there and senior teaching fellow. Doug, how are you? I feel like I'm coming back from outer space here, having been gone for 4 or 5 days.
Well, you know, I guess context Wednesday needs to follow Super Tuesday, right?
Well, yeah, Super Tuesday. I was on the airplane the whole way, so I was kind of divorced from the news.
You left the state of East Dakota?
Yeah, I did.
Super Tuesday?
I did, and well, that's because there's such a small population here. We only needed to be open for 5 minutes, and we got that done. We sat down and had our caucus together. And since both of us are stark raving conservatives, the decision was easy. But frankly, we dozed off, and I don't know how it came out.
So here's a puzzling question. How can the two of you both vote for each other in absentia?
Well, that's long been a mystery. You'll have to ask Emperor David when he gets back. I'm not sure where he's disappeared. Hadn't shown up this morning. It might be like post-Super Tuesday oblivion for him. I'm not sure.
But I hear you're now a superdelegate.
Well, yeah, I'm the only guy there, and so I'll be going to the I don't even know which convention now. There's two parties, right? As I recall, Democrats and Republicans. No, so far there's no third party.
Well, I don't, since you're from, you know, used to be from Minnesota and now from East Dakota.
Yeah,
you probably have to determine which of your favorite comedians to vote for, don't you?
We don't comedians. Well, I know of several. I'm perplexed by this whole thing, Doug. Have you settled on somebody that you don't have to tell us who it is? But I'm still waiting for Mr. Wright or Ms. Wright, as the case may be.
I don't think the word ambivalent does it justice.
Yeah.
I think the word conundrum starts to get closer.
Yeah.
And you know, if I had to pick somebody today, I mean, if I was the benevolent dictator who liked the religious leader of Iran who can pick the person.
Yeah.
There is one of the five left I would pick.
Okay.
But I don't know if most of the country would be with me.
Yeah, well, I don't know if most of the country is with anybody. It's hard to believe Mr. Trump has a solid following from coast to coast. And what I did see some returns yesterday from the various states. Without the sound, it was on the back of a distant seat in the airplane. I could kind of just make out the text, and I saw Mr. Trump addressing, having a press conference of some kind. They were flashing the results on there. The disparity in the voting between, you know, Virginia and Texas and Oklahoma and Alabama, that it could vary that much from place to place in this country with all the mass media we have, that a reaction could be different. I wonder what determines that. Maybe the strength of an organization that a candidate has in a particular state?
Yeah, they keep talking about the ground game, and I have no understanding of that. And I suspect that has a lot to do with it. But just so you know, within the last 24 hours, I sent a brief email to a reasonably well-known pundit name. I don't even know whether it will get read or not. But I said, you know, I think we need a new term. You know how they've last several years they've been using this term RINO?
Yeah.
Republican and name only. I think we need a new term to try to explain some of what's going on here, and it's called Avino.
Avino.
Evino.
Evino. All right.
Evangelicals and name only.
Oh, that sounds like a shot to me. It sounds like a truism, though.
And, yeah, I mean, if the yardstick was who best embodies the Beatitudes, be an interesting scorecard out there, wouldn't it?
It would be. It would be. And, you know, I've long been, and I've said it on the air many times, I'm a big Ben Carson fan, but so frustrated because the guy does not get a chance to talk. He doesn't have a neat 5-second punchline that he can throw out there. But you know, I've appreciated his efforts. I think he's got to stop now, though. I don't know how he can continue. So I'm looking around again.
Yeah, everything about that thing just mystifies me. At the same time, it intrigues me because obviously we're going down roads here that had never been gone down before.
It does seem to be a very different year. Yeah, different election.
And the whole predictive nature of the pundits, just they turn up empty in their predictions time after time after time. None of this fits logic. None of this fits history. None of this can be extrapolated in clean, neat ways and given a rationale. I mean, that's part of what's fascinating about all this. But at the same time, it's scary about all this. And my wife and I look at each other about every other day and said, thank goodness God is sovereign.
Indeed. Yeah.
You know, this quote from the Psalms, the princes of this world rattle their swords and count their horses and chariots, and the Lord but laughs.
Mm-hmm.
So when you bring the spiritual dimension to all this and ask, what is God, I know what he thinks about all this, but what is he allowing to happen here? You really begin to wonder.
Well, he manages the nations, but you got to wonder if he still has a place for us, for the United States of America, a role for us. Have we turned our back on him to the point where he kind of washes his hands of us and lets us go our way?
Yeah, there is that verse.
Mm-hmm.
They turned from the Lord, and he sent leanness into their soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this a period of time when God is going to send leanness into the American soul? I don't know the answer to that. But those are one of the whole mosaic of thoughts that just swirl around as you contemplate this fascinating and yet uncertain, ambiguous presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. And watch it from day to day.
Well, there is this commonality, though, and I hear it from all people. Now, even if they pick their candidate and they're happy with it, most everybody is still looking for a real leader. And I think that speaks to that big missing part in all of us, where we're still looking for the Christ. We're looking for the good and perfect king who can come and lead us all out of this mess. And so we grasp at straws, and I think there are a number of straws floating around us up there.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. While it's never said, it's certainly implied. I'm your Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm your Messiah if you want this sort of set of things to happen. I'm your Messiah if you want these sort of things to happen. And I'm the one who can lead you. And it makes for fascinating reading and pondering.
You know, my thoughts go back to the night of the election in November of 2008 when President Obama, while he was then still candidate Obama, had just found out that he'd won the election. You know, it was the night thereof. All the people had called him the winner, and he came out. He was in Chicago, as I understand it. It was a big gathering of his supporters out there. And I watched on television as the television cameras panned the faces of all those people waiting for him to speak. And when he arrived, there were so many misty-eyed, just worshipful stares. It really was unsettling to see, because my first thought was, these people are expecting a Messiah, and they're not going to get one. It was really shocking to me. It was just a very unsettling thought. But I think that's the case. We're looking for leaders, and we're not finding them.
Yeah, if you sign up for a secular Messiah, you've probably signed on to a Pied Piper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, listen, they were in Capernaum that night long ago, and they were listening to a teacher, and I wonder if they had that same look in their eyes, misty-eyed wonder, and or were they angry? Were they combative? Jesus had been healing and had a reputation. Wasn't this near the beginning? And I'm talking about Luke 5, of course, that night when the paralytic was lowered through the roof. Wasn't that near the beginning of his ministry?
If in Luke's narrative, it certainly appears to be. It's the second miracle that happens apparently rather quickly after he called the early disciples. So, yeah, I think you can say this is early on in his ministry, and that's helpful. Because you can ask, well, what has he done prior to this? And mostly what he's done is demonic exorcisms and some healing of people, although it isn't defined what kind of healing has taken place. He has healed Peter's mother-in-law from her temporary disease, illness that she had, and all indications are they're actually now in that same house where he healed her.
But there were healings and at least stories of healings among the northern Pharisees at that time anyway. I mean, was that unusual?
In terms of, I'm going to call it plain vanilla healings, lower down on the Richter scale of miracles, as well as demonic exorcisms, there was a long tradition of that happening by what was known as the Hasidim, the miracle-working Pharisaic rabbis who always came from the north. And I think early on here, particularly in Luke 5, up until the time that Jesus healed the leper, that's how he would have been seen. That's how the people in Nazareth would have seen him, I would suggest, in Luke 4, when he went back there and read from the Isaiah scroll one Shabbat. Here is another in a long line of the tradition of miracle-working Pharisaic rabbis known as the Hasidim. And aren't we proud that one of our boys here, Yeshua, is following in that long tradition? But that's a far cry from being the Messiah. Just the encounter before Jesus healed the leper, and many a rabbi had taught in that culture that healing a leper is as hard as bringing someone back from the dead. It will only happen when Messiah comes, when the Messianic age is launched. And so that's the significance of the leper being healed as the very first miracle that Jesus does in Luke after he calls the first disciples. That's why in the very next encounter, the prologue to it, that they've got all the heavyweights, the scribes, the Pharisees have come from all over Galilee, all over Judea and Jerusalem, because he healed the leper. That means he's on the radar screen as a potential Messiah. And that's why they're now out checking him out. That's part of why the courtyard is so crowded. He's on the radar screen. There's a buzz out there for Jesus. And the establishment has come to town to check him out. And so I would suggest the crowd that's filling this courtyard is probably one-third of the establishment from outside of Capernaum. And because they have arrived, they've created curiosity in the townsfolk. And so most of the other people in that courtyard are not people who want to get healed. They're curiosity seekers, I would suggest. They want to be entertained. And Jesus is a great show. I mean, he's going to do things that you've never seen before happen. You better be there. It's the place to be.
Yeah, I never considered the entertainment factor, but that's true of our own history. I mean, people going to tent meetings and revivals in the woods and just going anywhere before there was TV, before there was mass entertainment, just going anywhere to hear a bit of music or a lively speaker was a treat. It was diversion. And but it never, you know, we take Jesus so seriously here. We imagine deadpan rapt audiences here, but maybe they were just coming for a good time, huh?
Well, I think seeing people get healed, it would be fascinating to be around, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. I'd be drawn to that. But the irony here is these.
But see, these days we look at that and we say, it's a fake.
We might.
Yeah.
But with the tradition of the Hasidim as a backdrop here, I would say that these people would believe that these are real, I'll call them plain vanilla miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see some more. Remember, that's what Jesus said to his audience in Nazareth. You want me to dance. You want me to do the things that I've done in Capernaum because you basically want to be entertained, and I'm not going to do that for you. He sort of spurned social reciprocity right in their face, which further stokes their rage. And so, yeah, that's the thesis that I've sort of evolved towards here as I'm working my way through this passage, is that the vast majority of people here who packed this courtyard to hear Jesus didn't come to get healed. They came to be entertained. They came to see a spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted to say they were there. And the irony of people who don't want to be healed have created a barrier for someone who does want to be healed.
How big was this space, and how many people do you suppose it would have taken to fill it?
Well, in the reflection I put out a couple of weeks ago, I actually had a picture of a insula, meaning multi-room home, in Chorazin, which is about 2 miles from Capernaum, where this incident takes place. 2 miles as the crow flies, anyway. And it's about, I would say this courtyard is about 40 foot square.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of hundred people would pretty well fill it up.
It certainly would. Mm-hmm. And Capernaum is a town of about 7,500 people, we're estimating, in the first century. And when you factor in the out-of-towners who've come to check Jesus out, that's going to fill up pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the word starts to spread that Jesus is back in town.
You say courtyard, so this was open air, at least that portion of the building.
Yeah, there's a big square, and at least on the model or the picture that I have of one of these homes from Chorazin, two of the four walls of the square are just rows of rooms on the inside of those walls. Which then leaves the remaining space to function as the courtyard. And that's about the dimensions of a typical home. You can go to Capernaum and actually see what the outside dimensions were of Peter, mother-in-law's house. You can't discern what the internal layout was anymore because it has been built over and made into churches a number of times since then that they haven't totally excavated away. But the dimensions, the footprint of the multi-room home in Chorazin is about the same external dimensions as Peter's mother-in-law's place in Capernaum. So yeah, it's a pretty good estimate. And the reflection I'm going to send out as the third in this series, probably in about 10 days to 2 weeks, I actually have a recreation of what this might have looked like. And so you'll be able to get a much better envisioning here of how the two sides are filled up with rooms, how there's a complete grass roof, flat roof on the ceilings of these rooms, if you will, how you can see the doorway and they're actually representations of people in the courtyard. So I think it'll be very helpful for the readers of those reflections to have a visual image now as we continue to process what happens next.
It's easy to see how, presuming that Jesus was teaching from one of these rooms on the side of the courtyard that opened into the courtyard to the audience there, that it would have been difficult to get to him.
Yeah, as far as I conclude, pondering this, having visited these sites, trying to understand the dynamics of what's going on between the lines here in Luke's narrative, is that Jesus is standing in the doorways of one of the rooms that are on reasonably more on the edge of this compound. These rooms are going to be about 7 foot wide, and they're going to be about 15 foot deep. And each one of these rooms would have been the house of one of the sons in this clan. And so mom and dad live in the corner house, and then spreading out from there along two walls of this compound, this walled compound, will be a whole series of rooms for the sons, which then becomes their house. And then the sons, when they get married, they'll probably start to fill up the courtyard with the two remaining walls. And eventually this courtyard is going to get smaller and smaller as the number of rooms on the periphery of this compound get added to for the growing clan. But at this moment in time, I'm just assuming that two of the four walls are taken up with rooms, and Jesus has been pushed into the doorway of one of these rooms because the crowd just gets bigger and bigger and pushes more and more. I don't think it's reasonable to assume he's standing in the center of the courtyard with people all around him. The dynamics of people coming in and eventually moving toward Jesus would have pushed him back, standing in the doorway. And that makes sense here because in back of Jesus now, in one of these rooms, there is a roof overhead, and that's the hole that's going to be dug.
Now, you mentioned to us that these homes, these houses, were largely made of stone. And in that part of the of Israel, it was black basalt stone. So it was dark and hard. What were the roofs like? What materials were used?
Well, in the reflection two times from now, I actually have a picture that'll give a pretty good representation of that. There are going to be beams. They're either going to be black basalt beams, probably 12 inches square, or they're going to be logs that are 12 inches in diameter at least that now are going to span the two from wall one to wall two, side to side in this long, narrow room. And then a lattice effect is going to be created of, say, smaller four-inch, I guess we couldn't call them logs, but large branches. And then crosshatched across that in a lattice effect are going to be like 2 inches. And then on top of that, it's going to be a mat woven of palm branches, because now you're going to put down clay on top of that. And then you're going to put down dirt on top of the clay. And you've got a big roller, sort of like Grandma used to roll out the dough, you know, on the kitchen counter. And I've got some pictures of that as well. They're 3 foot long and 10 inches in diameter. And you're going to use this heavy roller to compact all this stuff down. And you're going to put then more clay on it. And you're going to roll it down. And eventually you're going to put grass up on top here. And so this is probably going to be 10 to 12 inches thick with a cross-hatch lattice of different size materials from branches to mats, to dirt, to clay. And the upshot of that is you don't dig a 5 foot long, 18 inch wide hole in 10 minutes in a roof like that.
Took some determination, some tools, some planning, some preparation.
Here's what I'm wondering about. You know, when they hatched this plan to bring him to Jesus, their notion was they're going to go through the entrance to the courtyard. Well, that didn't work. So now they go up on the roof, and my suggestion is going to be, in the reflection I'm writing right now, they did not go up on the roof with the idea to dig anything. They went up on the roof to say, well, let's go up on the roof, then we can get to the edge of the roof, and we can drop our friend then straight down in front of one of the doors that Jesus is standing in. But they, when they get up on the roof, they realize, hey, we're not the only ones who had this idea. Get up on the roof. Lots of other people beat them to the roof. And so there are people six and eight deep standing on the roof near the edge of it, because even though they can't see Jesus, they can hear him. And so even their plan to get up on the roof and to get to the edge of the roof, to then drop the mat over the edge of the roof down in front of it, that's not going to work. So I don't know how they came up with the idea to dig, honestly. I think digging a hole in the roof that we just described is unthinkable. A, you're destroying property.
Mm-hmm.
B, you're doing this for a paralytic who was an outcast in this culture. Now you're going to be identified not only as a friend of an outcast, but someone who destroys a roof. That roof took a long time to make. This is not an easy repair job. In fact, you almost have to dismantle the whole side of the roof to put this thing back together, okay? And people want to say, well, you know, you don't ever destroy property to do something for the kingdom. And I'm saying, honestly, I don't think that's true here. I don't know how they got to the point to say, let's dig. It's just a radical thought. And I'm still wondering how they got to that point in time. And so it's going to take some imagination to think that through contextually here. And that's what intrigues me about this passage. There's so much stuff that's just below the surface of one sentence in Luke's narrative. So when, I don't know how they made the decision to dig a hole in the roof, but they did, okay? That is really bold. That is really courageous. You talk about taking a risk in this culture. This is big time, okay? I think it shows how committed they were to this paralytic and how determined they were to get him healed. And so somebody had to go find some tools. I can guarantee you there aren't shovels up on the roof. Shovels are going to be out near the fields, okay? Mm-hmm. And hoes and rakes and those kind of things. I got to do a little bit of research here and find out what kind of agricultural tools were used in the first century in the northern part of Israel. But that's going to take some more time. And then they have to be found, and then they have to be brought back up on the roof, and then they got to start digging, and they probably have to rotate who does the digging. I mean, this is tough doing, and digging isn't going to get it done. You got to do some sawing here to get through the 4-inch branches and maybe the 8-inch beams. Okay.
This suggests desperation.
Yeah, it also suggests a long period of time. You know, maybe it took them an hour to pull this thing off. Meanwhile, it becomes obvious at some point in time here what's going on. And so the people who are on the roof near the edge start to turn around and see these guys starting to dig and hack at the roof. And they're distracted. They're trying to listen to Jesus, but they're watching these guys do their thing. And when it gets to the point where there's at least a 12-inch square hole that's been created, now debris is falling down into the hole, and it's accumulating in back of Jesus, and pebbles and rocks and clay and straw and part of the mat of palm branches is falling down behind Jesus. And the people who are in the courtyard now are looking at Jesus for
Mike again, Doug. Doug? There you go.
And they're seeing all this debris coming down behind Jesus, and they get distracted. And, of course, Jesus knows debris is falling behind. I mean, you get the idea here? I think this is just fascinating.
Well, I've often wondered about this. I mean, in our Western minds here, we're thinking, this is silly. They would cut a hole in the roof, destroy property. What? How come Peter didn't emerge and throw them off, have them arrested, hauled off? Which suggests there's more to this story than meets the eye, and filling in the context, this is something very valuable. We presume that it really happened, therefore there must have been some strong motivation for them to do that, and hearing the thoughts, the customs, the social norms around this thing is interesting.
All of these encounters. All of these miracles have fascinating stories that go with them when you put the context back in place. I may have mentioned it in times past, but I'll mention it again here. One of my favorite quotes comes from C.S. Lewis, where he said, "Reason is the organ of truth. Imagination is the organ of meaning." And so much of Western evangelicalism over the last couple hundred years has been focused on phrase one of that. We're going to reason people into the truth. And we've left the second part of Lewis's quote behind, using imagination to pull out the meaning of that truth. And so it's gotten to the point now where if you use imagination to teach a lesson or to preach a sermon, there are people who will look at you askance, like you're indulging in heresy. And I thought, how far we have come, how far we've missed what Jesus does. For example, earlier this week, I taught Luke 15, those prodigal sons, to a men's Bible class over in Virginia. And I was struck again how within two sentences, Jesus has got everybody in the audience on the edge of their seats when he says, a man had two sons, verse one, verse two, and one day the younger son came to his father and said, give me the share of my inheritance, okay? Which is a statement that has never been heard in that culture. No son would ever dare utter such a thing upon fear of death, okay? Honor killing. And so in two sentences, Jesus has his audience on the edge of the seat because he is the most imaginative storyteller the world has ever seen. Not only is he the story, he's the storyteller. And, you know, in Luke 11, when he tells the parable about the friend who comes at midnight, and he says, now, which one of you, if a friend came at midnight and said, I need bread and utensils, would say, go away from me. I'm sleeping. I can't be bothered. He expects his disciples to say, that's outrageous. That's unthinkable. That's beyond the pale. You see what Jesus is doing? He's using imagination to get their attention. He's framing something so preposterous that it elicits a response and gets them quickly engaged in the story. That's a pattern that Jesus does time and time again. So that might... with that as a backdrop, let me ask you a question. When you separate truth and imagination, who were meant to travel together as Siamese twins, okay? When you separate truth from imagination, what have you done? What unintended consequences have you created? That's what's happened in Western evangelicalism.
Well, you've largely taken the why, the answer to why, away.
Well, you've also taken away the meaning of the truth. and how to see it in action and how to see it applied and how to identify with it and how to appropriate it and place yourself into that truth because now you see its meaning. There are a lot of reasons why there's great deal of anemia in Western evangelicalism here. This isn't the only reason, but I think this is a contributing factor here. We've only embraced half of the great wisdom of C.S. Lewis. We've embraced that truth, or reason is the natural organ of truth, but we've left behind that imagination is the organ of meaning. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I've been trying to do in this passage. That's what context allows you to do, to create appropriate imagination, okay, within the confines of all the contextual parameters that are given in the clues and the words and the culture that we know of. And now we can open up the story appropriately. We can start to see the drama at work. We can start to see the interpersonal dynamics of the people. And it, even though we don't know their names, doesn't mean they're not human, doesn't mean they have thoughts and hearts and minds and feelings and emotions and fears and concerns. And when we start to identify that, now we place ourselves into the passage, and now that passage can speak to us like never before.
Another aspect to this, a question that comes to my mind, is why would Luke include this particular episode in his account? You know, what are the factors in this? Was it cutting through the roof? Was it the attention being paid to Jesus? Was it Jesus' answer, his verbiage there, his quote, pick up your mat and go home? What was the mystical, magical, captivating element in this story that told Luke, yeah, this has to be included?
Luke is a Greek. Luke is probably, of the four gospel writers, the one most committed to chronology, okay? Chronology is not necessarily a Jewish worldview thing, but it is a Greek worldview thing. Jesus has just healed the paralytic. And as I said before, the rabbinic teaching for many of the rabbis is that the healing of a leper is as difficult as bringing someone back from the dead. It will only happen when Messiah comes, okay? That's why everybody's on the doorstep here. Let me read Luke 5:17. One day Jesus was teaching, this is immediately after the healing of the leper, and Pharisees and teachers of the law were sitting there. They had come from every village of Galilee and from Judea and Jerusalem, okay? That's why they're there, because Jesus has healed a mm-hmm. leper, okay? Mm-hmm. Is this the advent of the Messianic age? Might he be the Messiah? That's the question. That's why they're there. So Jesus knows why they're there, and he wants to authenticate that he indeed is the Messiah, okay? That he is divine, that he is from God. And so what are all these four friends trying to get for their paralytic friend? Healing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when he finally gets down in front of Jesus, what does Jesus say?
You're forgiven.
Yes. He didn't say you're healed. He says you're forgiven. Why does he do that? Because all the people sitting in the audience who were part of the establishment know one thing. Only God can forgive.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Jesus says, I forgive you, he's claiming I'm God. And that's why the Pharisees, you can't do that. That's blasphemy. Only God can forgive. That's actually one of the few things they actually got it right. You know, mm-hmm. only God can forgive. They just couldn't see him as God incarnate. So that's why this encounter is here at this moment in time. Jesus is establishing his authority to forgive. That's only an authority that God has. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did you track with me on that progression?
Yeah, I did.
So until you get up at 5,000 feet and see the connectedness of this sequence of events, you miss it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have to think at ground level. We have to think at 5,000 feet, and we have to see what's going on at 30,000 feet all at the same time to really flesh these passages out.
And you don't just jump into Luke 5 either. You open your Bible to Luke 5 when you want to read about what we're talking about. Well, you better back up a chapter or two and start there to begin to understand. And this comes clear with your prodigal son's story, because it was the third in a sequence of three stories, three parables. And you need parable number one. You need parable number two to understand parable number three. It sets
exactly.
it up.
Exactly. And if you go up at 5,000 feet, just on this theme of establishing his authority, Jesus has already established his authority over his adversary in the 40 days of temptation.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back to Capernaum and establishes authority over temporary disease by healing Peter's mother-in-law. Then he establishes authority over nature with Peter and the great catch of fish. Then he establishes authority over chronic disease with the leper, and now he's establishing his authority to forgive. And in the very next passage, Levi, he points out how far can his forgiveness go? How deep, how wide, how broad can forgiveness go? Can it indeed forgive anything and everything? Okay, now that he's established his authority to forgive, how much can he forgive? And that's when Levi now comes out on Luke's narrative stage, because if there's one person in this culture who the rabbis have said can never, ever be forgiven, it's the poor tax collector in Capernaum who happens to be Levi. So at 5,000 feet here, there's a wonderful contextual progression going on, which unless you read Luke verse by verse and think on all three levels, 30,000 feet, 5,000 feet and ground level, you won't see the whole story.
Hmm. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why Doug Greenwald at Preserving Bible Times is such a blessing for us, such value to us. And a question quickly here. Can people go to the website, preservingbibletimes.org, and recapture some of the older reflections that you've sent out? Is there a way to do that?
They can.
Mm-hmm.
We've got about 20 or 30 of them that are down in the complimentary download section.
Okay.
And then there's probably another 60, 70, or 80 prior reflections, which are now all chapters in my book. But you can download them chapter by chapter for, I think, like $1.50 or something like that.
Well, I'd offer some advice that as you go to preservingbibletimes.org and sign up for the newsletter. It's Doug's Reflections Monthly, actually now a couple times a month. You'll get them in the email. There's no charge for that, and you will look forward to them, and you will learn a whole bunch. They will light up your day. You'll look forward to them intensely. And Doug Greenwald and Preserving Bible Time, just incredibly invaluable to us as followers of the Lord Jesus Christ because of that context. Brings understanding. It makes your Bible just pop out in three and even four dimensions and in full color. And just incredibly invaluable stuff. Yeah, Doug?
Well, we haven't done it total justice, so maybe we can wrap this up the next time we get together. But What's fascinating here is Jesus says, friend, your sins are forgiven. And that word friend is just powerful, okay? Mm. We just blow right past it. We don't even think about it. But what a fascinating word for Jesus to use, and maybe we'll use that as the opener the next time we get together.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start and also a good place to end today. Doug, thanks so much for joining us. Don't know what happened to David. I'll have to find out. I hope he's okay, because this was our return from vacation, and he's not around. We'll find out
maybe
what happened.
He's just overwhelmed it. Finding out he was a superdelegate from East Dakota.
That could be. Maybe he's maybe he's packing right now. Doug, have a great week. We'll see you next
Thanks.
Week.
Yep. Bye-bye. Jim, and shalom.
Shalom.